the antlers of the trophy frame his head, and it makes him look monstrous or demonic. It brought to mind the beasts of the woods.
There's no heroic violence here. This is all something that can taint your soul, and we're not going to let you off the hook.
Despair is intertwined with nostalgia and regret, lost love, and also a loss of youthful innocence.
It's very rare to see Cooper missing all of that. He's usually the one who's right on top of it.
Hello, friends. Thank you for coming back to Back to the Double R, a Twin Peaks rewatch. My name is Jonathan. I'll be discussing violence on this week's episode, which is the finale for season one, episode 8, The Last Evening.
And my name is Damon, and I will be discussing monsters and horror film tropes in this episode.
And hi, I'm Jennifer, and this week I am going to talk about heartbreak.
I'm Colin, and this week I'm talking about where the machinery of the puzzle of Twin Peaks leaves us at the end of season one. The season one finale is a night of heartbreak, horror, and violence in Twin Peaks. Having successfully lured Dr. Jacoby to Easter Park using Maddie dressed as Laura, Donna and James find what they were looking for in Jacoby's office, the missing half of the locket along with the tape. They play the tape back, which was recorded on the night of Laura's murder, and hear a twisted and brutally honest version of their departed friend, who confesses she did not love James. To his credit, James is glad he heard Laura's true feelings, and it helps to have two girls kind of in love with you. Meanwhile, Jacoby is attacked by a mysterious assailant, triggering a heart attack and a trip to Calhoun Memorial Hospital. North of the border at One-Eyed Jack, Special Agent Dale Cooper cozies up to Jacques Renault and gets him to spill several details about Laura's murder. The rest of the Twin Peaks Sheriff's Department is waiting for Renault on a stakeout. When the fuzz moves in on Renault, he grabs a deputy's gun and has Sheriff Truman dead to rights. Deputy Andy, who finds his courage and aim, saves the day by shooting Renault in the arm. Afterward, Leland Palmer goes to the sheriff's station to see if the killer has been caught. The villainous residents of Twin Peaks see their plans come to fruition. Hank Jennings makes a blood pact with Josie. Catherine, desperate to find her missing ledger, is led into a trap. Ben Horn is the mastermind of all the scheming. He sends Hank to take out Leo. As the jealousy-filled trucker is about to kill Bobby with an axe, Hank shoots Leo with a rifle. While Bobby is spared, Shelley is not so lucky. Before Leo was shot, he tied her up in the mill next to a bomb. Audrey is in even more danger as she awaits the boss at One-Eyed Jack's. As her father closes the deal on Ghostwood, Ben lusts after a turn with the new girl. Unrelated to the action, Nadine Hurley makes a suicide attempt. At the mill, Catherine releases Shelley as the building goes up in flames. Pete rushes into the burning mill to save his wife. At the hospital, a person walks into Jacques Renault's room and smothers him with a pillow. It is revealed that Leland, his madness curdling into vengeance, held the pillow down until Jacques Renault was dead. Finally, an exhausted Agent Cooper returns to room 315 at the Great Northern. He finds the note Audrey left for him there, and hears a knock at the door. Thinking it is room service, Cooper opens the door, where a mysterious attacker shoots him three times.
All right, folks, does anyone have any regrets or old business from the last episode before we move on with The Last Evening? I have one little itty-bitty one, sort of similar to last week. I don't know if I made it explicit, but Audrey Horn, also chaotic good. I was sort of hoping we make the connection between the log lady and Audrey in the last episode. They're both the same. And I'll say for this week, we are going to talk about Catherine, and I have her slotted as a lawful evil character, but we'll get to that in just a little bit. The Last Evening, season one finale. It was, it's a truncated season because Twin Peaks was a mid-season pickup back in, you know, the days of network TV, although they still do this from time to time when they had a, you know, show that didn't work out that gets canceled. They'll have another one that kind of fills in that time slot. That's what Twin Peaks was and why we're seeing, an 8-episode sort of half season here. It was originally aired on May 23rd, 1990 on the ABC Broadcast Network. And this episode is written and directed by Mark Frost. It's the only episode, I believe, that he is sort of in totally control of. One of the things I learned here from Reflections, the oral history of Twin Peaks, is that, you know, everyone really kind of like had a great time filming the finale, even though it kind of touches on bleak material. It was sort of almost like a victory lap for the cast because they spent all the time in Washington filming the pilot, and they all decamped to California to sort of, you know, get these 7 episodes in. And they all had a sense of like, you know, they've never really had a job like this. They might not ever have a job like this again. And so, you know, Frost, one of the things he did was he deliberately designed this finale to be filled with as many sort of like cliffhangers and like dangling threads as possible, because it was still sort of a question of whether or not ABC was going to pick up the show. Obviously did, and there's more Twin Peaks to come, but you know, if we find that it's even a little bit more action-packed than, you know, a normal season finale, that's sort of why. One of the things in the book here that they say about Mark Frost, and it's a quote from Piper Laurie, I believe. Give me a second here. She says this: "I loved working with Mark. He could tell me to do things that I wouldn't allow other directors to do, vulgar specific things like rolling my eyes. In my old Universal days when I was 18, it would drive me crazy when directors asked to do fake or superficial things, but I was confident enough and I trusted him. He would give me these tiny little tidbits to fill in the moments and scenes to make them funnier. I was timid about doing it, but he encouraged me. I really enjoyed working with him. And of course, in his movie, which is called Storyville, like, and Piper Laurie was a part of it." So, you know, I think Frost really sort of encouraged, in, you know, probably the same way Lynch, like a lot of creative freedom and built trust with his actors. It's a nice quote there from Piper Laurie, who we're going to talk about now. Piper Laurie, you know, long standing sort of actress of screen and cinema. She's had an over 70 year career, was born in 1932. So she's 89 now. And with as many of our sort of acting legends that we've lost over this past year, you know, hey, I'm hoping we get a few more years of, you know, Piper Laurie, you know, gracing us on the earth, and still glad that she's, you know, among us. But when she was young in 1949, she signed a contract with the Universal Studios. They gave her the screen name Piper Laurie. And she was like sort of, you know, in the same way that like Judy Garland or like Mickey Rooney were for MGM, like just one of their, you know, young stars. They just put in a lot of stuff, right? Like a lot of, you know, just sort of, you know, teen films or, you know, romances, stuff of that nature. They had like a lot of stories about Piper Laurie because her skin was so like just like white and porcelain. They said that she bathed in milk and ate flower petals. And so she was really a product of like sort of the studio marketing machine, and that's sort of how her career started. She, you know, worked with a bunch of different people and, you know, had numerous affairs, some of which are detailed in her autobiography that came out in 2011, which is called Learning to Live Out Loud. One of the things, and we'll touch on it very, very briefly, was that she had an affair with Ronald Reagan when he was in his 40s and she was still a late age teenager. So, you know, make of that what you will. She's certainly probably not the first young actress who had an affair with an older co-star. And I'm sure that still happens today, much to our sort of, you know, displeasure. Laurie, you know, had a decent career. And then in, you know, the mid 60s, she decided she had enough. She didn't want to, you know, be in Hollywood anymore, kind of focused on activism and raising a family. So the film that sort of brought her back into acting was very, very famous, 1976. She played Carrie's mom, Margaret White, in the Stephen King adaptation Carrie by Brian De Palma. It is a film that earned her an Oscar nomination, and it's certainly a classic of horror. So in a, you know, episode where we're going to be talking about a lot of horror tropes, it's nice that we have Margaret White sort of as one of the main focuses of our episode here. She, you know, just, you know, kind of goes and has a really great career from that point. And Twin Peaks, I definitely think they're trying to make her be almost like sort of like a dynasty style sort of, you know, like matriarch or, you know, sort of grand dame of sort of the drama. I definitely think that's where they're going with the character here. And, you know, I think all sort of the experiences and, you know, stuff that she had to deal with as a young actress, I think she brings it into her character as Catherine, right? Because I think Catherine is very much, you know, a woman who is forced to like play by men's rules and like a, you know, male position of power. And so she brings all that stuff in there. Last little bit I'll put in before I throw it to you guys. The other role that she's famous for, that she was also nominated for an Oscar for, was in The Hustler. And the name of her character is Sarah Packard, which would be Catherine's maiden name in the show. So I don't know if that's a coincidence or if Frost and Lynch deliberately wrote it in there. But what do you guys feel about Catherine Martell thus far as we've seen her in the show?
She's definitely one of the powerful women on this show. And this episode really highlights that. And I'll talk about it a little bit later. She's complicated and manipulative, and we see that really play out in a heartbreaking scene that I don't want to get into too much here, but her acting abilities in this episode are just stellar, as you really feel the power of her desperation and manipulation.
I think like a few of the scenes that we've seen before this episode, like I'm thinking specifically of, I want to say it was two episodes ago where, you know, she dances, right? Where she gets in there with Leland as he's kind of freaking out and like, you know, starts really, and really cutting a rug with him too. I mean, like what a great dancer Piper Laurie is. And, you know, then she like works in like his sort of his arm movements as like a dance movement. And so it's like, you know, this is a woman that's like intelligent and can like think on her feet. And I think as often have to like, you know, cover the butts of guys like, you know, Ben Horn, who, you know, just really is sloppy in like a lot of his work. And, you know, you get the sense that like Catherine has really had to deal with like just like a lot of like dumb men in her life or people that have like disappointed her. And she's not afraid to take charge of the situation, not afraid to throw her weight around. And, you know, you see that a lot with like, it's good that they got a nice experienced actress to sort of lend the authority that this character needs to, you know, make it really pop.
Piper Laurie is terrific. I really want to go back and check out her back catalog now, watch some of those old movies. I'll just add, I've loved watching her throughout the entire series, and I'll just add that there are a couple of interesting moments in this episode where she comes, where there are links to other women characters. First comedic moment is when she meets Shelley and says, "Who are you?" another interesting link is that in subsequent scenes, both Lucy and Catherine pick up the phone angrily and say, "What?" And it's interesting to sort of see Lucy evolving into a stronger character, which we, you know, we sort of see that echo in those two characters. I just love everything Piper Laurie does.
There's a really nice moment with her in this episode, I think, in which she kind of realizes how much trouble she's in. And she has this exchange with her husband, Pete, where she's asking him to try to basically remember what their relationship used to be like in the early days. And I love that scene because I feel like it adds so much more depth to her character. We get to see her be really human and vulnerable in that moment in a way where otherwise she might just seem like this sort of like monstrous character who's, you know, always got some kind of plots and machinations going on. But here we get to see that, like, you know, for all of her sort of tough exterior and all her scheming, you know, underneath there's a real person who has, you know, fears and insecurities just like everybody else.
And she also has insight in that scene about, you know, she talks about who she's become. And so she acknowledges that, you know, she has not been the nicest person to her husband or to anyone else, really.
It's a really great scene because, you know, they're asking her to do sort of two things at the same time. I mean, she's clearly manipulating Pete on some level, but there's also like real truth there. You know, she is like being vulnerable and she is like, you know, having to acknowledge kind of, you know, maybe, you know, kind of turned into like a woman that I never thought I would be when I was, you know, young and in love with you, right? Which she says that, oh, there was that summer of indiscretion at the lake. And I mean, that's like true sort of, you know, regret and sort of almost a, you know, wistful memory, right? But, you know, at the same time, you know, she is still scheming and she is still, you know, trying to, you know, get the best of, you know, Ben Horn and all these other guys. So really, you know, wonderful moment. And they often ask the actors in Twin Peaks to do sort of, you know, two things at the same time, right? Be vulnerable but tough, or to be, you know, you see it a lot from Hank Jennings in this episode too, right? Where, you know, he's charming Norma, but he's also just, you know, scheming in the background. So, you know, Piper Laurie just, I think, is really, really great at kind of playing both sides and, you know, showing all the angles of this great woman.
Well, and I mean, that's true to life, right? And that's how we know that this is a well-written adult drama, is that none of the characters are asked to be just one thing all the time. Or at least, you know, none of the characters that we like at all anyway. You know, you can be both sort of manipulative and also genuinely afraid and vulnerable, right? It's not either or in real life. Okay, so on this week's episode, we saw some really monstrous behavior on the part of a number of the characters. Hank and Leo both engage in horrific acts of violence. And Ben, as always, is scheming in the background for his own benefit. Accenting their shocking behavior, this episode, I believe, really leans into a lot of references to classic horror films, as well as just sort of use of horror film tropes. There are a number of moments that really stand out in this regard. One of these is the attack on Jacoby in Easter Park. And just as a little bit of a digression, one thing that stands out about this, aside from the sort of horror references, is that when Jacoby goes to the park, he sees what, you know, he is being led to believe is Laura Palmer risen from the grave. And so the fact that it's named Easter Park is probably no accident here. But after he's attacked, we get this slow zoom in on his eye with a black background. And this, to me, as somebody who's seen a lot of slasher films, felt really reminiscent of 80s horror. It feels like the beginning of one of the Friday the 13th films, when we sort of slowly zoom in on the eye of the Jason mask, for instance. And this goes right down to the sort of grainy film quality that we get as the zoom of the lens sort of reaches its limits. It kind of reminded me of some of the lower budget 80s slasher films, or maybe even like some 70s grindhouse type films. Another moment where we see what seems to me to be some horror references is when Hank goes to visit Josie. During this whole scene, he's being really menacing and horrible, and we see him being constantly framed by ominous animal heads. And we've talked already about taxidermy in previous episodes of the show, but I think it really stands out here. There's a wooden animal head of some kind that's carved into a big shelf with beer steins that's behind him. And there are two different hunting trophies we see sort of framing him. But what's most noticeable is that when he's sort of at his most menacing, he steps up in front of a high mounted trophy and he's being shot from kind of a low angle. And the antlers of the trophy frame his head perfectly. And it makes him look really monstrous or kind of demonic. It definitely, to me, you know, brought to mind ideas of sort of witchcraft and again, sort of the beasts of the woods, right? So in this same scene, he literally forces Josie into a blood pact, which is pretty gross. But the moment that sort of stands out there is that afterwards she rubs the blood on her lips as if it were lipstick. So the first thing that struck me there is that it seems like she's going off the rails a little bit. But it also brought to mind images of vampires, right? As she's putting the blood into her mouth. So we're learning and have learned over the last several episodes that Josie herself may be something of a monster, and here we see her depicted in this vampiric way. Later, we see Leo coming at Bobby with an axe, and he's got this crazed look in his eye. And I immediately thought of Jack Nicholson's character in The Shining, who I think is sort of similarly crazed and is using the same weapon. And meanwhile, up at One Eye Jack's, we see Black Rose, who's sitting in her signature black dress and reading tarot cards. And it's kind of interesting that she's reading tarot cards and there's nobody there. So I don't know if she's reading her own tarot or what the deal is, but it definitely, to me, conjured ideas of witchcraft. And yes, the pun there is intended. So here we are in this castle of vice and exploitation, and Audrey is being stitched up to meet the castle's master, who is, of course, her father. And the person who's preparing her to go meet him is an awful lot like Dr. Frankenstein's hunchback assistant, Fritz, from the Universal Studios Frankenstein movie. Fun thing I learned in researching this earlier, a lot of people think that character's name is Igor, but that is sort of a collective misremembering that we have as a culture. The character is named Fritz. Igor is actually a scientist in one of the Frankenstein sequels played by Bela Lugosi, who is not a hunchback. So just a fun piece of trivia about that weird little moment is that that hunchback character is actually played by Leslie Linka Glatter, who directed episode 6 and will go on to direct two or three more episodes in the next season. So there's a lot going on here in terms of depicting the characters as monsters or sort of invoking these tropes of horror. And I have two questions to put to you all, and feel free to answer either or both. The first is whether there are other horror tropes that you noticed in watching this episode or in previous episodes for that matter. And then secondly, of the baddies of the series, of which there are many, at this point, who do we see as being the most monstrous?
I have a horror trope that I'm not sure if others of you noticed, but there's a scene in Jacoby's apartment where Donna and James are hunting around for things, and there's a bit of music played that reminded me instantly of the Hawaii episode of The Brady Bunch, and that is sort of a horror-like episode of The Brady Bunch. It's a three-parter from 1972 called Hawaii Bound, and one of the boys discovers this tiki idol in Hawaii, and after they find the idol, all sorts of bad things start to befall upon them. So it seems like it's a haunted or possessed idol, and so all sorts of things ensue where they try to return the idol to its proper place, and they end up in a cave with Vincent Price, who ties up the boys. And I actually had to go back to The Brady Bunch because I was like, I know there's these few notes that are playing in Jacoby's apartment that sounded to me like something that was a refrain heard in these episodes of The Brady Bunch when the tiki, haunted tiki, appeared. And there is a similarity there. And of course, Jacoby is obsessed with Hawaii and has tikis in his apartment. And so it made me wonder if this is an intentional reference for the Gen Xers who are watching this, because, you know, for me growing up, I saw The Brady Bunch probably more than any other show. I even taped it around the time I was taping Twin Peaks out of a sense of nostalgia. And it was this very collective memory for many of us, and the same way that, you know, for Lynch, the 60s stuff was a collective memory. So I wonder if there's something about this horror of Jacoby maybe being cursed a bit because he has these stolen artifacts, because he does have things like tiki-like objects in his apartment. So that was the trope I noticed.
I'm a huge Vincent Price fan, but I had no idea that he had ever been on The Brady Bunch.
No, and like the fact that like, and you know, that he might be having like cursed idols, or you know, I mean, Twin Peaks is, itself is probably on like native soil. I definitely like that interpretation of, you know, what happens to Jacoby, or sort of maybe the consequences he pays for it.
And one, so there was a quote when I look back at the Brady Bunch episode. Peter says, "How could a dumb old piece of wood give you bad luck?" Which is sort of like, think about that line for all of Twin Peaks, really. So I'll just leave it at that.
Well, the moment that stood out to you, Damon, the slow push on Jacoby's eye really stood out to me as well. And, you know, I think it's so interesting you saw it in the context of 70s and 80s horror. I went back to our Hitchcock reference because he does that famously in the shower scene, at the end of the shower scene, although there's, you know, a rotation to the camera and so on. You know, it's probably one of those things that has been used many, many times. And so, you know, there's a word I love, palimpsest, where things get written over and written over and written over, and so that there are multiple meanings. And I think one of the things that Lynch and Frost do so well, and all their directors, is pull in these things that are deeply resonant and have a lot of different layers and levels to them. But I love this idea of people turning into monsters. And when we get to the end of our discussion today, I'll talk a little bit about what Twin Peaks has done to these various characters.
Like, it's nice that we focus on the eye, and Lost, a show that is heavily, heavily influenced by Twin Peaks. In almost every episode, they like start either with like a zoom in on the eye, or like a zoom in on a, or a zoom out on an eye from a character. It's not necessarily done for like a horror or for a scary effect, but like the, you know, when I saw them zoom in on Jacoby's eyeball, I'm like, oh yeah, Damon Lindelof or, you know, J.J. Abrams has definitely seen Twin Peaks many, many times, because it's a prominent feature of that show. In terms of the horror tropes, oddly, I found the part with Hank under those antlers like really comedic, like almost like like it's, you know, kind of framing him like a jackass, even though I know like donkeys don't have like, you know, horns like that. But it just seemed like I get where the, you know, the a demonic angle is coming from totally. But I'm also sort of like, man, he does look really silly like, kind of framed underneath those antlers. I almost thought it like undercut some of like a lot of the, you know, the dangerous stuff that he does get involved with. But, you know, horror can be like that sometimes. What is, you know, really scary for someone else is, you know, can find like really, you know, funny. Absolutely. And hilarious. Yeah, what do you got, Colin?
Yeah, it's that thing that we were talking about last week where the genres are blending together a lot, and especially comedy and horror. We talked about poor Waldo's blood on the jelly donut. The simultaneous terror of a creature of the woods, beast of the woods, like you said, Damon, spot on. Also, it's hilarious that he steps up and, you know, it isn't quite the, you know, two rabbit fingers up over his head, but it's scary and funny at the same time. Again, the lasting.
It's like he's trying to find his mark in that scene, because it's not, he's not just standing there with the demon, you know, horns over his head. He's sort of moving slightly back and forth, like literally like he's trying to find his actor's mark under the horns. So yeah, that's probably what makes it sort of, I don't know if I thought it was funny. I just thought it was, I was being told I needed to pay attention to it, you know?
It's also a, it's also a fairy tale reference, or it evokes a fairy tale sort of thing. And we talked about Twin Peaks as a dark fairy tale, and that sort of fit that very nicely.
I'll say a couple more things. The shot with the antlers was like totally planned out and staged by Mark Frost. Chris Mulkey comments on it in Reflections, and you know, just how it was just one of the things that like made the show more special than, you know, your average show on TV, was they took time to like, okay, we're really going to get you framed under, you know, these deer antlers here. Sort of the trope that I really paid attention to, and it's going to kind of lead into some of the stuff I'm going to say in my next section, but I'm happy to talk about it now because we can focus on some of the other aspects, is that end scene with Jacques Renault, you know, being, you know, having the life snuffed out of him. You know, you really see a close up on like his limbs just like writhing and shaking, almost like they're going to pull those arms off the hospital bed. And you see that all the time in, you know, horror movies where, you know, you think you're seeing like someone being smothered to death. But really, you know, all you're seeing is like an arm or a limb kind of like flailing around. And then your just imagination fills in the rest of, you know, the work there, right? You know, you see that happen in horror films all the time. They focus on a body part or like a, you know, a limb or something that is just moving in an unnatural sense, which, you know, heightens the violence, heightens the terror, just makes, you know, those scenes like all that more terrifying, that you're just, you know, this body is just doing something that it should not, you know, be really humanly possible, or, you know, that you humanly see. But, you know, as a lead in to sort of, you know, who do we think the most monstrous character at this point is, you know, I definitely think we can make an argument for Leland at this point, because we see him kind of go on a real journey from the pilot to this episode. You know, he's our classic just grieving father. And, you know, both he and Sarah are just two characters who are so filled and consumed with grief. But Sarah, at some point, I think, makes an active choice to be like, hey, you know, we have to get beyond this. Whereas we see Leland, you know, he sort of goes, like his grief sort of goes from, you know, just your, I don't know if you could call it standard, but you know, how you would expect, like maybe like, you know, a father who's lost his daughter to murder would be behave like really just, you know, crying, like, you know, diving on the funeral. But then he, like, it's that grief has moved into madness. We see him, you know, with the dancing and sort of the, you know, the strange erratic behavior. But here, it's like I mentioned in the intro, it's curdled into like a bloody vengeance, right? It's like he thinks that, you know, this man has murdered his daughter, and now he's, you know, he's killed him. And it's the first murder we actually see in the show, you know, where we actually see, you know, the life gets snuffed out of somebody. So you have a character that, you know, you think is like, okay, you know, it's a sort of, you know, I'm not scared of this person, but now his behavior has sort of changed into a way where you're like, what is Leland going to do next? I mean, because he's completely unpredictable.
Well, and the look on his face when we, you know, pan up from Jacques' body is just crazed. Last thing I want to point out before we move on, going back to the zoom in on Dr. Jacoby's eye, I just wanted to point out that that also calls back to a couple episodes ago. We had that same zoom in on the eye of a crow when the characters were going to meet the log lady at her cabin. And then, of course, that is also an echo of the zoom in on Laura's eye from the videotape where Cooper saw the motorcycle reflected in her eye.
My big theme, or sort of the takeaway that I had from the last evening, was the intimacy of violence. And David Lynch, especially, even though he doesn't direct this episode, but yet, you know, he's the creator of the show and his fingerprints are all over all aspects of sort of the creation and production of Twin Peaks. You know, David Lynch is known for having a lot of like really just graphic and horrible violence in his work. And I think this episode in particular really kind of highlights, I think, how he uses violence and some of the things that he wants to perhaps, you know, say or make sort of maybe some political statements about violence with. One of the first things we see in the show is, or I should say in this episode toward the beginning, is we see sort of a moment of heroism with Andy, who heretofore, you know, is shown as the guy who like drops his gun and it's almost dangerous for him to have one. But, you know, when Truman's life is being threatened by Jacques Renault, you know, it's a great character moment for Andy where he, you know, finds his courage and his nerve and he's able to shoot, you know, Jacques Renault. And, you know, it's, and he comes home and like, even like Lucy's there and kind of hears how brave he was. And it's, you know, it's this great moment for that character, really nice payoff. And, you know, it's almost shown in like a bloodless manner, because if a person was really shot like that, I mean, there would be a lot more damage. It would be, you know, far bloodier than, you know, what we see. And I think part of it is, you know, network television standards. But it's also, you know, this is coming right at the height of like, you know, the action hero as sort of the, you know, the you know, the mover in Hollywood. This is right around when we got guys like, you know, Bruce Willis as John McClane, or, you know, Mel Gibson in Lethal Weapon, who are like these men of action who, you know, you watch those movies and you're just like, man, this guy has a body count of like, you know, a couple dozen, you know, bad dudes under his belt. And, you know, we love those entertainments. I'm a huge fan of those action movies too, you know, but it's almost like Lynch and Frost frame this particular act of violence as like something that we can cheer for, that it's a moment of heroism. And then you contrast that with the murder of Jacques Renault. And, you know, the way that it's staged is you don't actually know who is killing Jacques Renault until you pull back and see that it's Leland. And so, you know, when you see this act of violence and you're like, man, like Jacques Renault got to be like 300 plus pounds dude. And yeah, he's you know, tied up in a hospital bed, but like, you know, the way to like kill a person like that just takes such like intent and malice and just true sense of like, you know, I am just going to snuff the life out of this person by any means necessary. And, you know, until it shows, you know, Leland at the end there, I think, you know, the camera work and things like that is meant to almost sort of like be like, hey, guess what, audience, you know, the blood is on your hands here too, right? You know, you're complicit in this act of violence as well. And, you know, you see so many other movies, like, you know, I'm thinking like Charles Bronson in like Death Wish, or a few years after there was like A Time to Kill, where, you know, you know, we cheer when Samuel L. Jackson like kills the guys that like shoots his daughter. But, you know, here, I think the show definitely wants us to be like, no. Like, you know, there's no heroic violence here. This is all, you know, something that can like taint your soul. And we're not going to let you off the hook. And I think that's true, you know, when you see some of Lynch's other films, like he made, you know, Wild at Heart, which has like this really horrible, like death by a shotgun that, you know, anyone that's seen that movie, you're like, oh man, I'm not getting that out of my head anytime soon. Or like, you know, in like Blue Velvet, where, and spoilers for Blue Velvet or some of these other movies, where like Frank Booth has like the gas mask on Isabella Rossellini, and just like how uncomfortable and unsettling all that stuff is. You know, Lynch, I think, really wants to be like, no. You know, you're not going to enjoy like someone dying here. You're going to realize that it's, you know, the act of taking a human life is something that taints your soul. So, you know, I just kind of wanted to see where we are in terms of the use of violence in this show, or, you know, how we feel about it, or, you know, sort of, you know, how we feel with this sort of level of uncomfortability here.
I definitely felt like this was the most violent episode we've seen. You know, there are tons of guns, multiple people have axes. We see the blood pact. And for me, the blood pact, I have trouble. I've read and watched a lot of horror and, you know, watch violent movies. But when I see people being cut and bleeding on screen, that's the point where I have to turn away. I mean, there are even books, Stephen King books, where I've had to put a book down when there are scenes with people being cut.
Oh yeah.
So that's the only moment so far in Twin Peaks where I physically could not look at the screen when the blood pact was happening, because that was just so intense and visceral for me. Yeah, I think that's what I wanted to share, was that it's a very violent episode, and that the bloody violence is what really got to me personally.
Yeah, I mean, in Lynchian projects, as you point out, Jonathan, there are a lot of acts of violence, but it's not ever glorified. It's always something that's like weird and ugly and makes you feel kind of gross and bad. And you know, I think here maybe the shooting of Jacques Renault by Andy is sort of an exception, but in general, the violence here doesn't feel good to watch it. We're not cheering for the characters who are doing this stuff. And it's funny, talking about this makes me think about the fact that David Lynch was actually asked to direct Return of the Jedi, which, you know, obviously has a lot of more like fun, like sci-fi fantasy violence in it. And it really makes me wonder like what that would have been like if David Lynch had directed that film.
And, you know, I think like what makes Lynch's approach to violence different than you know, say like you're George Lucas or something like that. And, you know, Star Wars is a fun movie and it's supposed to be, you know, for kids, right? Or it's supposed to be for family audiences. So, you know, there's, you know, people getting chopped up by lightsabers or, you know, people being zapped with like, you know, force lightning or something like that. But it's, you know, but it's clearly a fantasy. And well, I think that like this show touches on fantasy elements. And we've even said, oh, hey, it's bringing in fairy tale stuff. You know, it is still about the murder of a young girl and, you know, they find her body wrapped in plastic. And so, you know, I think a lot about how like people, you'll hear someone in this country. Oh, well, you know, I hope they get that guy. Or I hope, you know, like, oh, like that guy like shot a kid. Well, he deserves to die. And I think Lynch just finds all that sort of attitudes, like, I think really unhealthy and toxic. And so when you see, you know, like a father who is like literally coming to like claim vengeance for, you know, his daughter, or at least so he thinks, you know, I think in many, many other shows or in many, many other things, like that might even be presented as an act of heroism, right? Hey, you know, this is a grieving father who is, you know, taking matters into his own hands, right? He's ending the life of this bastard who killed his daughter, you know, but Lynch, they're not about that. I think they're really, you know, like, nope, you know, you're killing this guy too. You know, it's your hands that are like choking life out of Jacques Renault. And, you know, by all means, we shouldn't feel like any sort of empathy or pity for Jacques Renault. He's done, you know, a lot of horrible things, but does he deserve to, you know, to die like that? Who is that to say? Who are we to judge? You know, so I think, you know, Lynch, you really, I think, doesn't let the audience off the hook ever. It's like, you know, you're in here with this ugliness and this violence and, you know, you can't look away, right? This is something that's going to stick with you and not just, you know, be disposable. Like, hey, cool, we shot the bad guy that tried to kill the sheriff and we can feel good about it and, you know, go kiss the girl afterwards.
Well, and back to Jacques Renault, this is the episode where we're just repulsed by the man. You know, there are scenes with him that are just, you know, oh, it's just spine tingly. Just, he is just horrible, just a really awful person. So I appreciate your point, Jonathan, that despite all of that, because he is really painted in an awful light in this episode. So we should not have any sympathy for him at all. But, you know, we watch Leland, you know, literally strap him to the bed because he ties him up. He ties him to the bed with, you know, some sort of medical tape. And I guess to your point, probably that's the only way that he can overpower him is by having him tied up to the bed so that he can suffocate him. But yeah, it's complex. It's a very complex relationship to that, you know, us as the viewer watching that scene of somebody who we have seen as a real villain in this episode.
Now, you think you'd be happy that he meets his end, but you don't feel that. You're like, oh God, I feel awful afterwards. Like you almost have to like pause to, you know, the show and go wash your hands.
Well, much of the show up to this point has been implied violence behind, yeah, you know, violence off camera. So this is when it's really coming to the fore and we're left to grapple with that. This week, I was really struck by heartbreak on Twin Peaks. And most notably, the thing that jumped out at me was Nadine's suicide attempt. That scene just broke my heart. And it's emblematic of all the pain that we're seeing throughout the entire episode and how despair is intertwined with nostalgia and regret, lost love, and also a loss of youthful innocence and dreams. So I'm going to spend some time talking about this scene with Nadine, as well as a few other scenes that I think that really depict heartbreak in this episode. And the scene with Nadine, to me, is the most heartbreaking scene that I've seen on Twin Peaks up to this point. She's in her home, and we see her spreading out this red plaid picnic blanket. And she's all dolled up like an early 1960s teenager. She's dressed in a glamorous, girly, poofy pink satin dress. And she's arranged a silver tray with a glass of water and a a bowl that has flowers on it. And then she deposits these pastel pink and orange pills into the bowl. She seals an envelope, which you assume is her suicide note that she's left for her husband. And, you know, this is the scene. So the week prior, we saw Nadine's despair about her failed patent for these silent drape runners. And she expresses that she had these fantasies of a totally different life. So she imagined that this would be the solution to all her problems, you know, making it rich off this patent. And she tells Ed in that episode, while she's eating bonbons and watching Invitation to Love on TV, you know, she's like a true 50s housewife in that scene without a care in the world, you know, on the surface. But she tells him that she had big dreams and that she was going to buy them a new TV and perhaps a motorboat. And so it's like her suburban fantasy has disappeared in an instant, you know, with this failed patent. Yet in this suicide attempt, she still sets the stage for that dream of a perfect romantic life and in her stylized art direction of her suicide. And it's straight out of a movie. There's this pretty music and she says goodbye. And it's something I feel like I've seen before. You know, I can't put my finger on where, but it's just this very upsetting scene, which has some odd similarities, actually, with the scene of Audrey and One-Eyed Jax. And in fact, when the scene with Nadine opens with this plaid blanket being sort of tossed up into the air, that's what you see on the screen. And when I first saw that, I thought we were actually being taken to Audrey in the room at One-Eyed Jax. I was tricked by that. So it made me think about some of these similarities. You know, Audrey is also all dolled up at One-Eyed Jax, and her scene there in that room is also this horrible moment of heartbreak that's a little bit different. So we see Audrey's heartbreak at being confronted with her dad's true colors. And it's a classic teen girl coming of age moment that I've seen in a lot of TV shows and movies where suddenly you see your dad in this terrible light. And it's straight out of a Disney film too. And, you know, we've been talking about this scene. We've been touching on the scene and all the different aspects to it. Ben walks in and says, "Close your eyes." And then we hear a sound that it kind of sounds like the magic wand in Cinderella. And then Ben continues, "This is such stuff as dreams are made of," as Audrey gasps. So she realizes it's her dad. And it's classic Ben Horn as well, because he's reciting what on the surface seems like a romantic line. But when you actually realize the reference point, this line is from Shakespeare's The Tempest and also from The Maltese Falcon. And it's a line about artifice and things being an illusion. So, which is the case for both Audrey and Ben in this moment. They're both acting. They're both playing a game. They're playing parts. But we know that this creepy fantasy is going to soon be shattered. You know, we don't see the outcome of it in this episode, but we know that they're both going to realize that they are both in this scene playing these parts, and it is a wildly inappropriate meeting that is going to be a source of great heartbreak. So those are the two big heartbreaks. I just wanted to quickly mention, you know, a few of the others that we notice in this episode. James and Donna and Maddie, they hear Laura on tape revealing her true colors, which is also a heartbreaking moment for James in particular. But we see all of them sort of tearing up. We see Catherine manipulating Pete with romantic nostalgia. We also see Hank using romantic nostalgia to manipulate Norma. And then Jacoby literally has Laura's broken heart necklace. And then he has an actual heart attack after seeing ghostly Laura. So all sorts of heartbreak there. Lucy, we see her incredible disappointment when Andy reacts to her pregnancy news, not the way she expected he would react. And then Leo, who screams at Shelley, "You broke my heart," and blames her for his violent behavior. It's all her fault because she's having an affair. And then finally, I find it very strange that at One-Eyed Jack's, where there's so much imagery surrounding cards, I find it very strange that Audrey did not pick the Queen of Hearts, that she picked the Queen of Diamonds as her card. So I'm not sure if that's reading too much into all of it, but I'm curious for all of you about not only which moments were the most heartbreaking scenes, like from your perspective, but also considering all the violence in the episode, how does the violence contribute to the emotional intensity and heartbreak as well?
I'd like to start. First of all, like, we're just going to go back to Nadine for just a second here. In the Bill Simmons podcast, Three Watchables, he has a category which he calls the Dion Waiters Award. And it's named for a basketball player who scored a bunch of points and got a bunch of rebounds in a short amount of time. And sort of the concept behind it is, you know, who is the actor who basically like does the most with like a limited amount of screen time? And as far as I'm concerned, Wendy Roby is like that person on Twin Peaks. I mean, she may have only been in, you know, these 8 episodes, maybe like 10 minutes of screen time. And I think she gets kind of a bad rap because Nadine in these 8 episodes gets a lot of like really silly storylines, right? Like the drape stuff and like that scene where she's like literally like bending the exercise machine in half and some of her encounters with Norma. It's all really, really tangential stuff, but it's really brought home here. And you know, just in, you know, that minute she's on here for this episode with, you know, the way she sits and the way she just meekly says goodbye, which is underscored by a remix of the Twin Peaks theme, It's Falling, just played in a different form here. I mean, she's just so good and so heartbreaking. And like, you get like, you know, the whole story, well, not the whole story, but you get so many details about like where this character is and how, you know, she's lived her life and what she's been through. And she's just a magnificent actor. And so if folks are watching the show for the first time or coming back to rewatch and, you know, feel some sort of way about Nadine, I'm going to stick up for Wendy Roby on the show because she's awesome. It's just, you know, she does so, so good with like the limited stuff that she gives her. In terms of your other question, you know, I'll focus on like that part with Leo, you know, because, you know, you get just, you know, he's like, you're breaking my heart. And so you know, when you try to put yourself in the mind of Leo Johnson, which maybe isn't necessarily the most comfortable place to be, but, you know, you get these men who just think that like all their problems are caused by, you know, their heartbreak with women, instead of him owning up to the fact that, no, you're just a really crappy dude, right? You're a jerk. You know, you're not very well educated. You know, so instead of like, you know, wrestling with his own faults as a man, he's taking it out on, you know, Shelley. And I just think it's really emblematic of like sort of that mind frame where, oh, you know, you broke my heart. Well, you know, I'm going to take things out on you. And you know, it's just, to me, it's a sign of like emotional, like immaturity or, you know, which, you know, in Leo's mind is, you know, conflated with like this intensity or sort of an urge to, you know, right what he thinks is, you know, wronged him. So I think Leo is a real classic example of that.
Well, and he says, you made me do this, right? It is like the mindset of the abuser. The moment for me, so there, you're right. There's a ton of heartbreaking moments in this episode. And, you know, definitely Nadine's suicide is a strong one. One that really stands out for me is when they're playing back Laura's tape, there's a moment where you just get this silent exchange of eye contact between James and Donna. And for him, he is hearing someone who he loved say that she didn't really love him. And Donna, of course, you know, who is now in love with James, is feeling sympathy for him, but also she's having to confront some things about her own best friend, also departed. And there's just nowhere for either of them to go with that grief or those feelings because this person is gone. And that is a moment that has always hit me really hard. And just the look in their eyes as they make eye contact across the room, listening to that tape, has always jumped out for me. It's a really nice piece of acting without any dialogue.
Well, and it's interesting, they apologize to Maddie, like, sorry you had to hear that. So it's as if, as we're talking, I think I'm sort of figuring that out. It's as if she's witness to this intimate moment that they're apologizing for, because they are all, they're all quite upset about that.
Right. You know, but for Maddie, it's her cousin who it sounds like she didn't, hasn't actually been close to in quite a while. So, I mean, I'm sure it's hard for her to hear this about a family member or whatever, but I think part of what makes that moment really pop out for me is that, I don't know if you've ever had to deal with profound grief with someone you don't know very well in the room, but it's a really difficult thing, right? And it's difficult for that person because they have to be there and witness that. But it's also, I think, difficult for the person who's experiencing that that grief because, you know, you can't really be yourself in that moment when there's somebody else there who's kind of an outsider.
And well, she's also sort of a stand-in for Laura, so that complicates it too. So I don't know if they're also there's also that discomfort with the ghost of Laura always being there.
I used to work for AT&T. I took, you know, calls to fix iPhones, and more than one occasion, people would call in because they had like lost the last voicemail from someone who died or someone who passed on recently. And so like this scene really made me think of like some of those calls I had to take when I was, you know, working for AT&T, like trying to recover a lost voicemail. And so I really think it's effective. You know, like how you were saying, Damon, you know, you see James come to terms with it, right? Which is a nice acting moment for James Marshall, who really has just been a total nothing burger of a character up until like this point in the show. And it's also, it's nice that you point out like Donna's reaction because, you know, again, like, this is my best friend, but you're finding out like these horrible things about her or, you know, things that you just never would expect her to say or do. And it, you know, it like, it really throws her, but James is like, hey, I'm glad that I know. All right. Cause otherwise I would have spent my whole life like wondering like if she really loved me or not. So you see kind of the two sides of the same coin there. And, you know, like, and it's weird. Cause even people would say to me like, you know, this voice message, we were just talking about like going to the grocery store. We had like an argument or something like that, but you know, you hold on to those like last little bits of like voice or audio or, you know, the last time you ever heard someone.
This week for me, it's all about coming full circle. Except maybe not quite full circle because there are lots of cliffhangers and other things sort of in the works. But in the season one finale, we see the characters' fates bringing them to a place that reflects where they started through a lens of who they were or who they never were or who they never are going to be able to become. There are a lot of terrific echoes of the pilot, of course. This is directed by David Lynch. And the story is by Frost and Lynch together. So they're going back and picking up very specific things that they inaugurated in the first episode, the fact that we are finally getting the deal for Ghostwood signed. That sort of brings us full circle. And I'm not sure that we ever actually name checked the awesomeness of Ghostwood. I mean, you know, we could do a podcast on what the name Ghostwood means in Twin Peaks. And also, you know, we see at the very end, Cooper dictating to Diane, talking about the hospitality industry again, sort of he's back, he's come full circle and he feels like things are wrapping up, but of course they're not. We see a lot of genre climaxes. So I've been talking about sort of how genres are playing out in this. We see climactic moments in the episode that represent these different genres really well. We see soap opera tropes with Andy and Lucy and with Nadine. We see noir tropes with Hank and Leo. And we see the horror tropes that we've talked about, all the great references. And there are Hitchcock callbacks, which of course is something that they've been doing a fair bit. In addition to the eye that Damon and I talked about earlier, there's also a scene from a 1942 Hitchcock film called Saboteur, starring Robert Cummings. And there's a scene where an ancillary character runs into a burning building carrying a fire extinguisher. And it's hard for me to imagine that that isn't a callback in some way. And what's interesting about that movie is that although it isn't exactly a cliff, it sort of has one of the ultimate filmic cliffhangers at the end of that movie. So I feel like there's a shout out to cliffhangers in general. There's a lot about dreams and dreaming, which we've also seen throughout this. Norma tells Hank, can't blame you for dreaming. And as Jennifer noted, Ben's quote, such stuff as dreams are made of, there is this dreamlike quality that is kind of running through a lot of the action. And this is where it pivots, I think, into that arena of dark fairy tales, which we talked about on our very first episode. This episode, the finale, starts on Jacoby's imaginary island, sort of this lingering shot on the picture on his wall of a sunset over an island, which kind of evokes the conversation of Shangri-La, which is Tibet, or Brigadoon that we were talking about, right? Someplace that exists out of time. But then we also have imagery in this of blades carving through timber, which I still think is, a visual statement on how Twin Peaks is going to take apart these characters. We have lots of smoking and fire, obviously, which Jen called out in an earlier episode. And we also see that birds come back and figure into what's going on here. Jacques Renaud, in his monologue, says, that bird, it was like he loved Laura and he's pecking on her. That's both a Hitchcock reference and also evoking this theme that we've heard throughout of birds being almost other characters or agents of another world, something like that. They're doing a lot of structural work in that way, but maybe more importantly, a lot of the characters arrive. They get their payoff here in this episode. So, and it has a whole range, of course. Andy goes from, as you were saying, Jonathan, dropping his gun to having this moment of zen and becoming the perfect lawman, which is really fun to see. We see Hank in his true colors. He's a vicious killer, but he's not just cold-blooded, he's also a cruel psychopath, and we sort of see all of his registers of emotional, psychological, and physical violence. So he really comes to the fore. Leo kind of gets his, but Hank really becomes a villain. We also see Catherine and Pete, who have a relationship that is, a cold fish type of relationship, made explicit with an actual cold fish. We see their relationship playing out against a literal burning building. a literal raging fire. So their relationship has had this interesting twist. I really was glad that you guys were talking about what Leo shouted, because in the way that all these characters are having their moment, we had said last week that the violence between Leo and Shelley is among the scariest stuff in the whole show, because it reflects something real and it reflects something that Lynch seems to be trying to do, to sort of talk about this horrible violence that men perpetrate against women. And I just wanted to echo, Damon, what you flagged. You know, that relationship between Leo and Shelley comes to a pinnacle when Leo screams, "You made me do this. You broke my heart. You made me do this." That in this, you know, in the same way that, you know, Lucy's reaction is the soap opera genre, you know, Lucy's reaction to Andy, her disappointment and sadness, that's the apotheosis of the soap opera genre. Leo screaming, "You made me do this," is the apotheosis of this true thing of real male violence, which is hard to take. And then finally, and I think this is so important too, we already flagged this, Leland, you know, he is broken. Like Sarah, he is broken, but he's had this really interesting arc where we saw a couple of episodes, he's sitting in the dark, Maddie is sneaking out of the house, and he kind of emerges from the dark and then sinks back into the dark. And when he crosses that Rubicon of murdering Jacques Renault, he has that broken, fractured, sobbing moment. And then the sound cue of the bell changes, and he snaps into this other character, this like intense, focused, silent, calculating character, you know, the character who set off the fire alarm, you know, smashed the fire alarm with a rock. So Leland has gone from being Ben Horn's right-hand man to kind of this split, and, you know, who knows where that's going to go. And I would say that there is one big important thing. All of these characters arrive in various places, and some characters may or may not continue into the next episode. But Cooper, who thinks all is well, he's talking to Diane about 24-hour room service, you know, he's in his happy place. But for somebody who has been able to see through everybody this entire show, who has seen messages as small as the letter R underneath Laura's fingernail, for somebody who has been tapping into dreams, he completely misses all of these communications at the end. You know, for all of his special vision, he doesn't get to open Audrey's letter. The phone call from Andy is garbled and he can't hear, and he has no capacity to anticipate what is happening when he opens the door. He thinks it's hot milk, and it's very rare to see Cooper missing all of that. He's usually the one who's right on top of it. So, you know, that's sort of where he ends up, put in mortal danger because his faculties failed him. So, you know, it's a beautiful pair, a beautiful mirror image of the pilot. It does a lot of work in the genres, and all the things that you guys talked about, I thought were just great. And I guess I have sort of two questions for the crew. One of which is, you know, what does it all add up to for season one? Does the show payoff on its promise from the pilot. And, you know, in at this moment, the darkness really seems ascendant. You know, Hank is on the move. Leland has become a murderer. Cooper has been, you know, blinded to the threat. So with all of these genre climaxes in soaps and noir and horror, why do we see basically no supernatural forces at work in this episode?
I'm going to chime in just with a little bit of trivia. The shooter at the end of the episode, it's a director, Mark Frost, who is pulling the trigger there. So that's a nice little bit of a thing to pull in. But like, it's funny because I felt one of the things that Damon and I were talking about before, it was a potential question. It was sort of like, I don't know if we actually talked about it before, but you know, if the show ended here, how would we feel about it? And you know, you like, we're probably further from the answer of who killed Laura Palmer than we have been at like any point in the show. Like, they don't really come back to Cooper's dream. They don't really come back to like a lot of those supernatural elements. Like, it's really just been muddied by kind of all like the drama that's been going on in Twin Peaks. So, you know, I think, you know, I don't know if like a first time viewer or people who are coming back to it are like frustrated with the show at like this point in time. But yeah, we're kind of left in utter chaos at the end of this episode. Our hero is shot. Like, we're no closer to any sort of answers that was sort of promised at the beginning of the show. And we're really left in a, you know, place where we're like, man, like at one point you're interested in to see what happens next, but you're like, it would have been nice if we got a couple answers or so.
I mean, I have sort of I like the way you, Colin, I like the way you laid out kind of where we've come since the pilot. And I've been thinking a lot about Jacoby in this episode. And at the end of the pilot, you know, he's listening to Laura's last tape on his headphones and he's got his coconut. And at that point I was creeped out by the man. But in this episode, we're getting more of his backstory. And I think that's happening with a few of the characters. We're getting more of the humanity and the nostalgia and the backstory of all the characters. And I just wanted to drop a few little tidbits from that scene, because James and Donna find this puka shell covered box that has some trinkets in it. You know, it's old paper umbrellas that Jacoby had from trips to Hawaii. And one of them has to do with meeting Mimsy. And so, of course, I had to go down a rabbit hole. And the best I could figure, well, there are a few things. Mimsy was a word introduced by Lewis Carroll in Jabberwocky. And that seems to fit with a lot of this fantastical, and we even sort of alluded to Alice in Wonderland elements. And then Mimsy is also the nickname of an actress who was an extra in the Gidget film, Gidget Goes Hawaiian, as well as was in a 1970s horror movie. And we've been talking about 70s horror, The Perfume of the Lady in Black. And we also had the Lady in Black in this episode with Black Rose. And she was also, Minzy Farmer, this actress, was also in Riot on Sunset Strip. And Russ Tamblyn, who plays Jacoby, his brother Larry was in that film playing in the band The Standells. So, you know, my mind just continues to be blown by Twin Peaks, but you figure this can't be an accident, you know, to have these random little clues in the coconut.
No, it's really a love letter to film and to television, as I think we said in the pilot and probably throughout the show here. Just one other little item like that. When Pete is rhapsodizing over his yearbook that he thought was lost forever, the girl whose name he says is Midge Jones, and Midge is the Barbara Bel Geddes character in Vertigo. So we've had so there's another little Vertigo throwback in there too.
It cracks me up so much that we've got Maltese Falcon, Brady Bunch, Vertigo, you know, Gidget movies. And I mean, at times I feel like a crazy person who's like, am I just pulling these things out of nowhere? But I mean, some of this has to be intentional. And I can't actually Google much beyond this or read any of the books yet because I don't want to hear any spoilers. So this is just my interpretation based on the text.
You know, the show is all about secrets in a lot of ways. And I think, and Colin talked earlier, several episodes back, about how it's a puzzle, right? And so I think we're supposed to look for these pieces. And that is what makes me think that, I mean, certainly some of the things that we've talked about could be coincidence, right? But a lot of them definitely are not, because we're being encouraged to peel back the layers of the onion, again, to use a metaphor that I think Colin used several episodes back. And there's a lot underneath those layers. And so to come back to your question, Colin, about sort of where we feel like we've ended up from the start, I mean, speaking to my own experience of the first time that I watched this, when I hit the end of this episode, I just couldn't wait to find out what was next. And it's not just because of all the cliffhangers, although certainly, you know, there's a ridiculous amount of cliffhangers in this episode, but it's because you get the sense at the end of this episode that 8 episodes in, all we've done is scratch the surface, and there's so much more still underneath for us to find, whether it's these sort of references to other television or other film, or the secrets of the characters themselves, or, you know, this supernatural stuff, which, as you pointed out, this would have been kind of a natural place for us to come back to it. I think the fact that we don't actually makes you want to know even more what's going on with that stuff, right? Because it's like, well, wait a minute, what about the Red Room? And I think there's an intentional choice being made here to make us wait to find out what that's all about.
It is nice you get the payoff with the locket, because it's such like, you know, that's the lasting image of the pilot. And then I think in Traces to Nowhere is when a Jacoby like listens to the tape, which we finally hear in, you know, in full here. So it's not like we're left in like total, like, you know, like chaos land, or things are, you know, getting unresolved. They are bringing things back in. And like, even with a, you know, Nadine, that, like, that's a full circle moment for that character arc, right? Where, you know, she, it seems innocuous. She has like, oh, I, you know, have this idea for the Drape Runners, and then it, you know, pays off with it, like this really poignant moment. So it's not like there isn't, you know, things that pay off, but it's certainly, you know, there's the sort of a low level, like, parts of the story, and there's larger level parts of the story. And like Damon is saying, you know, we're just kind of getting to the surface of like a lot of the mysteries and secrets that Twin Peaks has yet to, you know, unfold at this point in the show.
Right. At the end of this episode, we've peeled back the top layer only to see that there are so many more layers.
Well, that brings us to our final twist. We've had a long and interesting journey doing this podcast in season one. It's been a blast for us. We hope you've enjoyed season one. We're looking forward to kicking off season two very soon. In our final twist here, we're looking ahead a little bit. We're thinking about cliffhangers and character arcs. So as this season wraps up, what was your favorite cliffhanger? What is the thing that is going to keep you on tenterhooks until we get to season two? And who is the character that you are most interested in seeing their story from here on out?
I mean, I think I'm really, looking forward to is probably the wrong way of stating it, but you know, when Ben and Audrey meet,
God. Yes.
I'm going to be curious to see that scene and how it plays out. And I mean, it's going to be bad. But I think I need to see the resolution to that.
That is some deep awkwardness there.
Yeah, there's no way that's going to go. That's not going to be like gross and unpleasant. That is definitely up there for me. I mean, maybe it's just like the part of me that loves old movies, but I feel like the, you know, Pete running into the burning mill that we know Catherine and Shelley are presumably inside. I mean, that just feels like such a classic cliffhanger to me. I mean, I would say Agent Cooper, right? Because everybody loves Agent Cooper, but I mean, let's be real. Like, are they really going to kill off Agent Cooper? Probably not. So, so I would say, you know, if I'm seeing this for the first time, it's gotta be Pete running into the burning mill. As I've said, I think Pete is the most likable character, and seeing him come to any harm would just be terrible.
For me, I wrote in my bio on the website of the show that, you know, when I first watched the show as a kid, you know, to me, like, the hook was who killed Laura Palmer. And when I watch the show, it's still who killed Laura Palmer, you know? So I'm like, if I was watching this now for the first time, or if I was back in 1990 watching it for the first time, I'd be like, who killed Laura Palmer? When are we going to get the answer to this question? So I'm very much invested in that. And for me, I guess the character that, you know, I guess invested is the wrong word, but the one that I want to discover the most about is Killer Bob. You know, we don't really know a whole lot about Bob or how Bob works or how it fits into the whole mystery. They kind of, you know, haven't really come back to him since we saw him last. And so to me, that's really the stuff that I am most interested in. It's like, who or what is Bob, and how does that figure into the mystery going forward?
It's tough, man. Every genre has a really compelling cliffhanger or end point. And most of the characters do too. So are you watching the soap opera Twin Peaks? Well, that raises all kinds of questions. Or are you watching the film noir Twin Peaks? Well, that has other questions and other cliffhangers. Or are you watching the supernatural horror mystery Twin Peaks, which has yet more questions and characters? So it's really hard for me to answer this question. That's why I ask you. I'm bewildered by the whole smorgasbord of content. You know, I love all the stories. I love all the characters. I was deeply creeped out by the Benjamin and Audrey Horn thing. There's something interesting there. Each of the dark sides of their characters brings them there. You know, Audrey is a chaos agent, starts the episode as a chaos agent and evolves into, you know, sort of a Nancy Drew. Then quickly, you know, we leave Nancy Drew type mysteries behind. She's put herself in this position, and
she's in way over her head.
She's in way over her head. What a nightmare. You know, this is the ultimate dark fairy tale. And, you know, Ben Horn coming in, it's speaking lines from Shakespeare. It has a real Shakespearean vibe, you know, where, you know, everybody's killing family members and mistaken deaths, and, you know, so that is kind of the, you know, juiciest and most terrifying individual piece. But I'm really interested in, as you say, Damon, like, we just scratched the surface. What else is simmering underneath?
Well, and interestingly, it's only as we're talking about this, you know, the only way that she was really going to get out of this horrible situation is that it's her father who's the boss. You know, if it wasn't her father that was the boss, this scene would have played out really horribly. So in a way, her father is saving her in that scene. But, you know, another thing that, so this week I also was doing my little, you know, crime map on the whiteboard sort of situation. So that's the other thing that I am hoping to figure out is how all of these business all these business machinations behind the scenes are going to play out. I mean, it seems like Ben Horn is at the top of everything, you know, owning One Eye Jacks, and, you know, he's in cahoots with Josie to, you know, kill off Catherine, as it turns out, to get $1 million. But then Catherine is supposed to be, or then Josie is supposed to be paying more money to Hank, but Hank seems to be beholden to Ben. So I still don't feel like I really understand, you know, the whole pyramid of these bad actors and the organized crime, you know, behind the scenes. So I'm looking forward to get that getting sorted out.
I'm going to get you some conspiracy yarn for your birthday so you can start connecting all the dots. One thing that I wanted to mention too, we already flagged this. And I meant to say this before. Josie, in that horrifying moment where she starts rubbing blood on her lips, that's an echo from the very first scene of the pilot where she's painting her lips in front of the mirror, this blood red. And Jennifer, you were 100% right to call that out in our very first episode. And so I was so glad to see it come back amped up in this horrifying vampiric way.
Well, yeah. And there was, you know, even though I don't remember everything since it's been a long time since I had seen all these episodes, but I think in that first scene in the pilot, that to me was reminding me that there was something going on with Josie. You know, I was remembering bits and pieces from when I'd seen Twin Peaks the first time around. And so now we know.
One thing I'll say, if anyone is out here listening or, you know, wants to add us on our socials or something like that, don't spoil nothing. And we do want to kind of keep everything sort of, you know, preserved. I know this is a 30-year-old show and there's tons of stuff about it, but, you know, just play along with us. And I guarantee there will be some of these answers to these questions my co-hosts have been asking. And certainly Damon and I, who have, you know, been through multiple rewatches, are going to have a lot of fun when we find out the answers to these questions and sort of how well the creators have already maybe planted some answers to these mysteries, or, you know, how well kind of all the, you know, the pieces come together for, you know, various different things. So, you know, believe me, we're aware of the stuff that's going on. You don't need to remind us on, you know, any of these exterior channels, but just to, you know, have fun with it, because the show is supposed to be fun. You know, for as bleak and crazy and odd as it gets, you're supposed to have a good time watching it. So, you know, just, you know, like if you're burning to tell us something, you know, you can tell Damon or I, because we know, but, you know, leave everything else sort of, you know, let us, you know, let our co-hosts have the surprise, and any first time or, you know, lapsed viewers who are, you know, listening along with us, just, you know, hey, don't worry about it. You will get answers to some of your questions.
That seems like a great place to leave off.
Okay, folks. Well, then we are very, very happy that you have decided to take time and download us. I don't know if you're listening to us while you're, you know, cleaning your house or doing dishes or working at some job that's totally drudgerous. But we do appreciate all of our listeners. We thank you so much for, you know, listening to Back to the Double R, and we'll have Silencio take us away. See you next week, folks.